For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, Gil Gross here, and it is time for another mailbag where I answer your questions, your hot takes, your observations, and ultimately your comments on tennis or anything else. Posted on the YouTube community tab over 24 hours ago. Got huge participation this week, which is always appreciated. We were well into the triple digits in terms of number of comments. Some Indian Wells stuff, some fun, creative, evergreen comments in there as well, and I can't wait to get into it. Let's get to the first comment. It is from member Amugs Game. Hi, Gil. This is a WTA-related question. It's a bit different, so I hope your viewers would be interested. There have been a lot of one-time slam winners in women's tennis over the past 10 years. Since 2013, there has been Bartoli, Panetta, Stevens, Ostapenko, Wozniacki, Andreescu, Kenin, Krejcikova, Raducanu, Rybakina, Vondrousova, and Goff. Could you rank these players from worst to best? You can approach it from the point of view of who you think has had the best career or who's the overall best player, or you might prefer to rank them in terms of peak performance from what you have seen so far, given that many of these players aren't even close to retirement yet, or both. Also curious to know which of these players you most enjoy watching play, but that might be going too far. I haven't seen a question like this in the mailbag yet, so hopefully it will catch your interest. Yeah, it certainly is an interesting one, and it got 20 likes, so a lot of people were certainly interested by this. So thank you for the comment, and thank you for being a member. If you'd like to contribute to the channel, you can hit the join button on YouTube to become a member. It is a donation of $2 per month. Highly appreciated, highly helpful. So, okay, there are multiple ways to approach this question. I'm going to do it in the way that feels most natural to me, which is to kind of just put these players in categories in my mind. And you asked me to go worst to best, but I'm going to go best to worst if that's all right. So the first category, going again best to worst, are the players who are likely to leave this list. You know, there are two players on here. I'd be shocked if they retire as one slam winners. Very shocked. So obviously that elevates them above the rest, and that is Coco Gauff and Elena Rybakina. After that, there's one name that stands out as a player who sustained excellence over a long period of time. And I'm talking, when I say excellence, I'm talking tier one elite level excellence, Caroline Wozniacki. So I think she's in that second category by herself. If you look at her career, and I'm looking at it right now, somebody who won the WTA year-end finals, made a final of the year-end championships as well, made three major finals, ended up winning one of them, but then there's an additional 1, 2, 3, 4 semifinals. And then at the Masters 1000 level, she won six 1000 titles and several other finals. So you look at Wozniacki as a player, I think we understand the reasons why she didn't win more majors, but just looking at the excellence she sustained, even weeks at number one, another thing that, you know, Wozniacki has a lot of weeks at number one. She's almost unlucky to only come away with one. Again, we understand the reasons, but most players who profile like Wozniacki in terms of how many final weekends she made at slams, how many 1000s she won, most players who are able to accomplish those things, weeks at number one, win more than one major. So Gauff, Rybakina, Wozniacki, then it gets a lot more crowded. I think this second category, players who I am not surprised with that they won a major. Like the fact that they won a major makes a lot of sense, does not surprise me. But the fact that they haven't won more also doesn't really surprise me. Okay, so I think this next group of players, I feel like I just feel like them winning one major makes a lot of sense. Sloane Stephens, Bianca Andreescu, given the health issues that she would end up having and the mental hurdles that she would end up having to overcome as well. Markéta Vondrousova. So I wouldn't be shocked if she doesn't win another. I think she can win another, but I wouldn't be shocked if she doesn't. Yelena Ostapenko. Sofia Kenin. Most of those players have a level of physical and technical talent that is at the level of somebody who can go all the way and win a slam, right? All of them have a level of tennis capabilities, at least at one period of time, which for many of them are a period of time that is a little bit short, probably for their liking, where, okay, this is a slam winning level of tennis, but they weren't able to sustain it for whatever reason, or they are inconsistent by nature, or they are spectacular in certain aspects of the game, but incomplete in some way that makes them a little bit more vulnerable. That's the third category of player. The fourth category of player is players who I'm surprised. It's surprising that they want to slam, which is okay. It's not a slight. It's not to take anything away from what they accomplished. But sometimes in sports, there are outcomes that are unlikely and they end up happening, right? Like, not every outcome is a likely outcome. And I think there are some players on this list who happen to win a major, but it, given what their regular level of tennis was throughout their career, it was an unlikely outcome that they were going to win a major. So right now that's Krejcikova, Panetta, Raducanu, and Bartoli. I'm a little bit hesitant on Bartoli and to a lesser extent Panetta, because they were a little bit before my time as a very close, knowledgeable observer of tennis. I remember when they won their majors. I was there, I was watching, but you know, I was a little bit more casual. So a little bit hesitant, but I even think, like, looking at where they would normally end up in the rankings throughout their careers, I think it's fair to say that they won their slam title runs are an example of variance. So there you have it. That's how I would categorize those players. Let's go to the next one. This was the top liked comment, comes from Ron Robbie. Aside from the obvious choice of Sinner Alcaraz, what are some, let's say, five matchups that you consider stylistically entertaining or exciting from a viewer perspective and hoping to see when a draw comes out? I wanted to kind of include some of the replies to this one because it's so subjective that certainly any answer is valid here. Max Dangvu says Sinner Medvedev is not spoken about enough. Yeah, Sinner Medvedev was one of the most entertaining head-to-heads last year, no doubt. And then someone else is weighing in and says Shelton versus Alcaraz, Sinner versus Runa, Medvedev versus Shelton, Runa versus Medvedev, Djokovic versus Sinner, Alcaraz, Runa. Yeah, I mean, look, I think there are certain players at the top of the game that it's gonna be pretty simple, right? Any combination of the players are going to create head-to-heads and matchups that I personally think are highly interesting and highly entertaining. At the end of the day, what I love is elite-level tennis. And when two elite players face off against each other, to me, there is basically nothing better on this planet. So there aren't a lot of combinations that I think don't work in this respect. It is also, when you think about the number of combinations, it's overwhelming. I was actually thinking about it. I was thinking, how many matchups are in the top 20? And with my very feeble, borderline insufficient math skills, I had to Google this because it is kind of complicated, right? I Googled how many combinations of two are possible in a set of 20. And yeah, like this sounds like some sort of, you know, AP level math question. But Google told me 190. That, you know, there was a website. I forget what this is called. But yeah, 190 different possible matchups in the top 20. So it's pretty overwhelming. You can't consider all of them, right? But a couple that came to my head, I agree on Sinner versus Medvedev. Unpredictability is a big factor for me. Like, I like head-to-heads that have gone back and forth quite a bit. Head-to-heads that I'm kind of thinking like, I don't know who has the edge here. Tsitsipas versus Rublev has always been a good one. I feel like they've gone back and forth quite a bit. And then there are some that are just based on storyline, like Rune versus Alcaraz. I always want that. I always like that. You know, just because of first of all, they both play a very exciting brand of all-court tennis, but Holger feels like he should be on Carlitos' level, mentioned alongside Carlitos. I think Holger feels that way, and it's nice to see Rune kind of take the court and try to prove that, you know? And I don't think that matchup has happened enough, so I always root for that to happen. Fritz versus Paul right now would be a lot of fun. Again, I mentioned at the top that I'm concerned for Tommy at the moment, but that is such a fascinating contrast to me. They are one ranking spot apart. They obviously are going to be in a battle for the position of top ranked American. And it's a guy in Fritz who hits the ball so beautifully but doesn't move as well. A guy in Tommy who moves around the court so beautifully but doesn't hit the ball as well. And I find that to be a fascinating little head-to-head. They've played some epics also. Acapulco last year was insane. I like to watch Hugo Humbert play top players on grass. Why? Because he can challenge them. And he's a fascinating player to watch in general, but I always find that interesting. There are players like Shelton at night on Arthur Ashe at the U.S. Open. Always sign me up for that. There is a certain energy that is associated with that combination that I got to see in person, Shelton Tiafoe quarterfinal night session on Ashe. And I know that won't go down as some sort of awesome match, you know, in terms of quality. But I'm telling you, the energy that Shelton brought to that and the connection that he had with that crowd was special. So, look, I can go on and on here. This is not an easy question to me. I know that it got 50 likes and people, you know, I hope this answer wasn't disappointing, but those are the kind of some of the things that sprung into my mind. Next one from Red Leggett. Does Carlos's variety end up being the thing that separates him long-term from Sinner? If Carlos continues this risk-averse sound tennis, I'm not sure Sinner will ever be diverse enough and athletic enough, regardless of Sinner's clear power advantage in all aspects, to win consistently at majors. Okay, there are a few things that I would push back on here. The first thing is, yes, Alcaraz found a more high percentage balance at Indian Wells. He was able to rein in his shot selection, add more height, more spin on the forehand, mix up his speeds, take a little bit of pace off at times as well. And that certainly helped him. But that's just 1 week. So I wouldn't say that in 1 week Alcaraz has gotten to a place where he's closed the consistency gap that potentially exists between him and Yannick. That said, I understand the question you're asking. There's one other thing I want to address, which is Sinner's clear power advantage. That's another thing that I don't think is as clear as maybe you think it is, right? Alcaraz's forehand is the heaviest in the world. I think when he has time on the ball, it's a little bit heavier than Sinner's. Now, Yannick might have it might be easier for Yannick to produce high ball speeds over and over again without missing. And Sinner probably doesn't need as much time to produce the high ball speeds. I think Alcaraz is gets rushed more easily and also probably doesn't produce as much pace when he's on the run compared to Sinner. But if you're loading up on a forehand middle of the court and it's just, here's a ball to attack, like I'm feeding the ball nice and easy, lands right in the middle of the court and just wail on it. Alcaraz, I think, actually hits harder than Sinner. Okay, so with those caveats aside, the basis of your comment is very, very much relevant and very much on point because it goes back to the way I looked at the Sinner versus Alcaraz debate, so to speak, when it was in its infancy. Like I made a video, Sinner versus Alcaraz, who's better, back in 2021. At this point, Yannick was much more of a known entity, but Alcaraz, after making the US Open quarterfinal and beating Tsitsipas in that high-profile five-setter, Alcaraz was starting to become a very known commodity in his own right, more as a prospect. Again, not as an established top player, but as a prospect. At which point, it was kind of clear that Alcaraz was going to be nipping at the heels of Sinner and potentially passing him at some point. And they ended up playing, I think it was in Paris. Might have been in Basel, but I think it was in Paris. And I talked about that match and what I saw. And at that point, I said, look, I do think Alcaraz is going to have the better career. And the reasons you're pointing to in this comment was the reasons that I alluded to. I said, Alcaraz is a better natural athlete. He moves better than Sinner already, and he will likely always move better than Sinner. And that is still the case, but Yannick now moves better than I ever thought he would. You know, that's the main area. I've always had an enormous amount of faith in Yannick Sinner mentally and technically, and I've always thought that he was going to be, I've always thought that he's great at improving his game. So I've been, look, I've never worried about Sinner in a big way. The only area where Yannick has kind of proven me wrong is how athletic he's become. Because when I saw him as a young player, I just thought he wasn't given the gift of elite athleticism. Like, I don't think, I didn't think that God graced him with that. But clearly that was wrong because he now moves extremely well. Really by any standard. So is it an Alcaraz level of court coverage? No. Will it ever beat? No. But I got to say, like, Sinner has done a great job of minimizing that gap. And then the second thing was the auxiliary shots, the creativity and the improvisational aspects of the game. Particularly when it comes to playing in the forecourt, playing drop shots, playing volleys, playing slice, when the point breaks down and it becomes a cat and mouse situation, who's better, and all of those things. Where Alcaraz, way back in 2021, clearly had a huge advantage over Sinner. Still does, but again, Yannick has done a really good job of making himself highly competent. Pretty good in all of these areas, all things considered. But he probably will never be Carlos. Like, Alcaraz does things in terms of his touch and his hands that are as good as I've ever seen outside of, like, Federer and John McEnroe. Like, that's how good Alcaraz's touch is. So Sinner, as hard as he is working on it, it will probably never get to that. Does, you know, so you're asking me, are those the things that will separate Carlos long term from Sinner? And my response would be, if Alcaraz does indeed separate himself long term from Sinner, those are likely to be the reasons raw athleticism and court coverage, right? Just superior athleticism and superior variety and auxiliary weapons, just, you know, anything outside of serves, forehands, and backhands from the baseline. And anything else I'll call auxiliary, right? And Alcaraz is superior. So if Alcaraz does indeed separate himself from Sinner long-term, it will be for those reasons. But that's still an if, right? Sinner is going to have something to say with his serve, with his return of serve, with his ground stroke consistency. And those are the reasons why perhaps Alcaraz won't separate himself from Sinner.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Next one is from Pasai. Why does no one consider Steffi Graf the women's GOAT when she has the Golden Slam most weeks at number one and at least four wins at each of the majors and just one slam fewer than Serena? And she retired at 30. It doesn't even seem close to me, yet she is barely spoken about. Okay, so I am not going to do the GOAT debate right now in any kind of definitive way, because I just don't think I'm the best person to do it. I think there are people who covered Steffi Graf throughout her career, covered Serena Williams throughout her career, and are, you know, excellent historians of the game. And like, I much prefer to leave that to them. They see the full picture, the full context. They were there and I wasn't. So I fully respect that. But what I will say right now is, first of all, and I've said this when it comes to the male GOAT debate, as soon as you cross eras, it becomes really hard to come up with a definitive answer. It becomes very complicated. Numbers alone are sometimes insufficient because context becomes more and more important. That in itself should make people a lot more hesitant to label Serena Williams the GOAT. But then when you go even further and you start to understand that when you look at the numbers, Serena is not clearly the GOAT, that there are some areas where Serena reigns supreme, and there are some arguments for Serena Williams as the greatest of all time. There are also some arguments that it is Steffi. There are even some arguments that maybe it's Martina, especially if you include doubles. But it's clearly not straightforward. So what I'll say now, without delving into the comparison of Steffi and Serena, it did rub me the wrong way when Serena was being presented as the GOAT, undisputed. Let's just say it what it is on an official capacity, as if she had some right to that title. When she was on her retirement tour, it did rub me the wrong way. Now, it was not the time for me to say that. So if you asked me this at that time, in the heat of the moment, I would have kept my mouth shut. Not because I would have feared the backlash. Believe me, that is not the reason. The reason is that moment in time was about celebrating Serena, not comparing her to others, not, you know, bringing any negativity to the conversation. Like, it would have just been inappropriate at the time. I think enough distance has passed that I was glad to see this comment pop up, because I don't think it was right. Like she was introduced to center court, and I will admit, was it kind of cool? did it make the moment a little bit more epic? Yes. But when she walked onto court, I don't know if it was every match, but I know for certain it was the first match that she walked on at the U.S. Open in 2021. She was introduced as the GOAT. Was that right? I don't think so. By the book, I don't think that was right. This wasn't important enough to really get in the way of the celebration, but I also think that it's pretty easy for me to say this, and it's pretty clear to anyone who looks at it objectively, Serena is not clearly the GOAT. Steffi is very much in the conversation. Next one is from Glenn Brewster. Medvedev overperforms expectations again in Indian Wells. I was so impressed by his willingness to throw out his old playbook and reinvent the way he plays Carlos with his baseline return position. Did you notice any other changes that he made? What else can he do to defeat Carlos? Well, I agree with you. There was a major improvement compared to even last year when he played Alcaraz. He took away the path of least resistance for Alcaraz, in the head-to-head, which was a lot of serve and volley and a lot of serve plus drop shot. The first ball drop shot, you'll remember when they played last year at Indian Wells, was basically an automatic point winner for Alcaraz. And the serve and volley was pretty close to being that as well. So at least on this occasion, with Medvedev's return position, he took those options away for the most part. He made Alcaraz beat him in baseline rallies. That was lower percentage for Carlitos. It made things harder on Carlitos. And in the end, he still got the job done. Now, Medvedev also, you know, he did surrender more missed returns than usual because of the closer return position. But I think all in all, the return strategy ended up being successful. And I think if you're Medvedev, here's the mindset that you look at it. You say, these are Alcaraz's best conditions as far as hardcourt is concerned. I was more competitive and I did not serve even close to my best. So looking at it from a glass half full perspective, if you're Daniil, it's if the conditions were more normal, like they are for most of the year on hard courts, not like Indian Wells, and I serve better, and I implement the same return strategy, now I have something going here. Now I have a really good mix of tactics and paths to victory to beat Alcaraz on hard court. So Daniil should feel really good about himself. Other things besides his closer return position, I just think in general there's more aggression in Medvedev's game. And he wants to come forward more often. He wants to hit a little bit bigger from the back of the court when he has balls to attack. And he's just trying to get more comfortable with the offensive side of baseline tennis. And the transition game, whereas I think in the past he has coasted more on playing neutral, playing defense, and that's been his baseline game. And I think he is definitely broadening his horizons in that respect. If his serve, and I think there's I don't want to talk too much about it right now because I think there are comments about it in the mailbag, but if he can go back to serving the way Daniil Medvedev was serving at his peak, he's going to be a real problem to deal with. He will be the best version of himself that we have ever seen. Next comment is from Austin. Can Sinner compete with Alcaraz on clay? When Novak retires, do you expect Alcaraz to dominate the clay? Look, I think a lot of the advantages that Sinner has over Alcaraz in general are somewhat muted by the clay. First of all, I think when the tempo of play gets really, really fast, Sinner is more organized. And Jim Courier used a good word, more programmed. So when you're more organized and you're more programmed and you have shorter backswing on the forehand, you can be more consistent when the tempo is really high. So I think Sinner's more comfortable in the quick tempo. It's part of the reason why when we saw Alcaraz flip the script and start to play better tennis against Sinner at Indian Wells, he actually slowed things down. He hit the slice backhand more often, and he put more air and spin under his forehand. So that made it more difficult for Sinner to open up the court, to rush Alcaraz, to get Carlitos out of position and then change direction into open court. All of those things became more difficult. On clay, when the game slows down a little bit more, that favors Alcaraz. And the second part of the equation is just the serve return battle. Sinner is still a better server than Alcaraz. Sinner is still a better returner than Alcaraz. The more points that are affected by the first couple shots of the rally, we're talking about free points. We're talking about serve plus 1 points, you know, service winners, aces, aggressive second serve returns, which is an area that Sinner, Alcaraz is very good at attacking second serves with his return, but Sinner is still better at it. So when the conditions are quicker, a larger portion of the pie is going to be these quick bang bang points where the serve and the return are deciding the outcomes. On the clay, there's going to be more neutral baseline rallies. Is that better for Alcaraz? Does that make his athleticism stand out more? His creativity and his variety and point construction stand out more? Does it help his forehand? All of those things. It helps Alcaraz. It hurts Sinner. So, look, without hesitation, I will say that clay helps Alcaraz against Sinner. At least it should. But I will also say that we have not seen Alcaraz 2.0 on clay. And you can look at the statistics right now, or you can look at Sinner's clay court season last year, and you can easily come to the conclusion that Yannick's worst surface is clay. I find that to be completely misleading at this time. You know, Sinner clearly was a better player from after last year's U.S. Open and beyond. And he hasn't played a clay court season in the current iteration of who he is right now. Just hasn't happened. So I don't read into those stats. And I think in general, Yannick's game is going to translate just fine to the clay. There's nothing about his game that concerns me in clay court conditions. I think he has the consistency. I think he has the movement. The weight of shot certainly is going to be an asset on the clay. He's going to be able to hit through the courts. I think he can finish short. His drop shot and his drop volleys are going to be key. And I think he's going to use them often on the clay, and we're going to see just how good they are. But the fact that he's willing to go to them now, it's going to provide him an opportunity to finish short in the court. There's nothing. I have zero concerns for Sinner moving on to the clay, but it certainly helps Alcaraz in the head-to-head more generally. Next one from Dr. Fearfall. Thoughts on the new tennis game, Topspin 2K25, which is coming out in a few weeks. A lot of players were seen testing it last week at Indian Wells. Personally, I have been waiting for a good tennis game for many years. Topspin 4 was the last good tennis console game, in my opinion. As we are a similar age, I was wondering, did you play any tennis games when you were younger, and did you intend to try Topspin 2K25? The only two games I played when I was younger was Topspin 4 and Wii Tennis, if you're going to even count that. But I was very into sports video games when I was in middle school and high school. So I know international audiences, that every place calls school different things. That's from ages like 12 or no, younger. I was into video games from like 10 to 17 years old, essentially. And I'd play a lot of sports video games. I had a short stint with Topspin 4 and I enjoyed it a lot, but it didn't have a lot of staying power, especially because while the NBA and NBA and MLB and Madden NFL games would update year after year after year, Topspin was only once. Look, here's what I'll say about this right now. I don't know if this is going to be like how successful Topspin 2K25 is going to be, how popular it's going to be. I have not played it. I did not get to play it, so I don't know how good it is. But video games are a good example of a growth opportunity for tennis when it comes to young audiences that far exceeds the potential that, you know, any of the format tweaks that are thrown around and discussed in terms of trying to get young people into tennis, right? So, for example, when people say, like, the third set should be a 10-point tiebreak, or majors should be best of three sets, or there needs to be a shot clock, all of this stuff about the format that some people in the sport like to think makes some kind of difference in terms of young people. And I think it's so off base and so nonsensical, right? To think that they're, and this is what I always say, think about the people in your life who are not interested in watching tennis and then say, hey, you want to watch it now that it's best of three? Any interest? Nobody goes from, yes, I want to watch best of three, to no, I don't want to watch best of five. I have yet to meet those kinds of people. And I scarcely think they exist. Now, on the other hand, you look at something like a video game. Now, here's something that can make a major impact. How many people do I know who started watching European soccer because of FIFA? Holy crap, a lot. Like, potentially the biggest entry point into European soccer amongst US children is FIFA. And why? Because FIFA's a kick-ass video game. Like, FIFA is awesome. FIFA is tons of fun. And, you know, it gets people to learn the players, learn the teams, figure out what a through ball is, figure out what formations they're into, learn what offsides is. All of these kind of initial barriers to entry that exist when it comes to any sports. And a really fun game like FIFA can knock down all of those walls and bring people into the sport. Video games, if they're successful, they make a difference. They bring young people in, not format changes. Again, I can't talk about Topspin 2K25 right now because I don't know if it's any good and I haven't played it, so I can't speak to that stuff. But I will speak to the potential power of video games, and it is absolutely enormous. Here's one that only got 3 likes, but it's from a member in Plains and Palm Trees, 747. Hi, Gil. Always appreciate your work. Especially enjoyed hearing your commentary during the Arizona tournament. Thank you. My question is regarding what you said on air during the delay-riddled Berrettini versus Cazot match. Let me start by saying it was very scary to see what happened to Arthur in Miami, and I'm glad there doesn't seem to be anything seriously wrong, and I hope he recovers fully and quickly. The question, you mentioned in your commentary that he's a very athletic, explosive player and that his pre-match warm-ups are also high intensity, calling them boxer-like. I'm curious about that. Could you elaborate? Sure. So it's not just physical, it's also mental. This is an example of where my access, in my opinion, gave me some good insight into potentially why Berrettini handled some of the stops and starts better than Cazot, with the caveat that ultimately Cazot was up 5-3 in the third in that match. So, you know, he easily could have won it. But when it rained, I went back into the players' lounge, and I saw Cazot waiting to come back on court. And I can tell you, he was not saying a word to anybody. He had his headphones in, wasn't even looking up. He was basically staring into one spot, completely locked in, trying to keep his focus, like laser focus. And I thought to myself, wow, so, you know, there's a guy who is trying to stay fully locked in during the rain delay. He does not want his mind to wander for a moment. Like, this dude is ready to go. And at first I'm like, okay, that's good stuff by Arthur. Like, way to stay focused, you know? But there is a flip side. There's a flip side to that, which is when the rain delay is 5 hours, that is exhausting. It is very tiresome to do that. So, you know, not to mention, you know, in his warmups, he was just jumping around and doing tons of dynamic warmups constantly. He was a ball of energy like Rafa. You know, everything you see from Nadal, you may have saw it in Breakpoint with the highly intense warmups. It's not like everybody does dynamic warmups, but I think there's a range to how much energy you put into it. And I think some players are at a 3, some players at a 5, some players are at an 8. Nadal's at a 10, Cazot's at a 10, where like they're really going at it. And again, if you're doing that 4 times in a 24-hour period, that becomes very tiresome. That's not to say that Arthur's doing anything wrong. It's just that in this specific circumstance, compared to Berrettini, who is much more talkative, is kind of hanging out, chilling, you know, on his phone, checking Instagram. And I don't know for a fact he was checking Instagram, but I do know that he went to his phone during the rain delay. Arthur didn't. He literally was staring at like a spot on the wall. That's how focused he was staying. So all I'm saying is it was fascinating to see the contrast in approaches and then potentially how that materialized on the court, because unfortunately for Cazot, it became an exhausting 24 hours of rain delays on the court, off the court, on the court, off the court. So that is why in my commentary, I brought that up. Next one from Joshua Krieger.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, Gil. I'm interested to know why your older videos are down on this channel. I saw there are no videos pre-2021. I wanted to go have a look at what your opinions were on certain players back then, but saw that the videos have been removed. Any reason why? Do you have any intention of re-uploading them or putting them on a different channel? Thanks a lot. So the reason why there are no videos out here pre-2021 is because those videos suck and are embarrassing. That is the reason. So I took them down. Look, at the time, they didn't suck. And I appreciate those of you who watched me back then. I know some of you still watch me now. But you can attest to how much better I am at presenting my thoughts, at speaking in front of a camera into a microphone. I've gotten a lot better at this. And in general, I think what complicated things for me is that the internet is forever. And in some ways, what I do here on YouTube, every time I come out here, and I don't think about this constantly, but it's somewhat of a job interview, a resume. Like every time I put something out onto the internet, I assume that anybody in the world, whether it be a potential employer, a potential sponsor, a, a podcast company, some boss somewhere or anywhere might see it. And they are going to form opinions based on what they see. And they may or may not notice that it's from 2021. So there's just something naturally in me that wants everything out there to be of a certain quality. And that's why I took down my old videos, because I wasn't proud of the quality. Simple as that. Let's do two more. Then I'll tell you why I'm wearing a hat for this video. I don't think I've ever worn a hat on this YouTube channel. And then we will wrap it up. All right, this is from the Emerald Gamer. Hi, Gil. Wanted to ask you about Dominic Thiem. He has unfortunately gone from probably the biggest threat to the big three from 2017 to 2020 and a Grand Slam champion to losing early in challengers. Just today, he lost 6-2, 6-1 to a guy ranked outside the top 200. What do you think needs to be seriously improved in his game in order to at least compete at a top 50 level? I think both ground strokes and the return have become really inconsistent to the point that even Dominic doesn't know if they will go in or not. Also, do you think Thiem has it in him to make it back into the top 50? How about the top 30? He implied that if he doesn't end the year top 100, he will retire. Do you see that happening? If he makes that choice, where do you think he'll call it quits? Yeah, so a lot of questions. First of all, I'm not going to speculate on the retirement, but I did see those comments. So in case anybody doesn't know, Thiem has said if he doesn't improve his results, this is probably going to be his last year. We'll see if he sticks to that. I mean, players change their minds all the time about that kind of thing. I also didn't see his match, the 6-2, 6-1 loss in the Challenger this week. I didn't watch it, so I can't speak to what happened. I've covered a couple things with Thiem over the course of the last couple years. The forehand is not what it used to be, or not even close. And I don't know if that's something medically that happened in the surgery that, I mean, look, the wrist is really important. It's one of the major components in how well you can hit a forehand, is how flexible and how strong your wrist is through the point of contact, especially once you start, you know, accelerating your arm forward. So maybe it is a physical thing, but what was puzzling is that Thiem at certain points in time has said that it's mental, and that's why the forehand is not the weapon that he used to be, which to me is almost hard to imagine, just because you would think if it were mental, you would at least see maybe in practice or maybe certain periods and of certain flashes of the old Dominic Thiem forehand, which was the biggest, baddest forehand really out of, you know, on the tour. You know, maybe him and Matteo Berrettini and Nadal, except he moved a lot better than Berrettini. So what's been eye-opening to me is when you take a player and Thiem and you take away that forehand, how ordinary the player becomes. Not shocking to me, right? Because what was he winning with? Like, think about it. Was he winning with his serve? Was he winning with his movement and his defense? Was he winning with his backhand? Like, the answer to all of that is no. He was winning with his forehand. That was the shot. That is the shot, period. So I think that's a big part of it, but also something that I've theorized with, and it's really hard to prove this, but when it comes to his overall game, his fitness, you know, maybe him struggling on the return or the serve or just his overall, again, everything, I do wonder if the work rate ever got to where it was before he won the U.S. Open. Because after he won the U.S. Open, he talked about the motivation being a struggle. I do think that the work rate went down as far as how hard he was able to train every day and how with what mental and physical intensity he was able to play his matches week in and week out. And I think that stuff went down, and he was not having a good 2021 season, and that was before he got injured. So I don't know if the fire in his belly that admittedly was diminished after winning the U.S. Open ever made a full recovery. Last year, he was healthy the entire year, and he did not climb up the rankings. He basically jogged in place right around 100 in the world. So I have no faith that he will return to the top 50. And there's no intricate analysis involved in that statement. It's just a matter of what the trend is. And the trend over the last 2 years is he's not improving. So if I predict that he's going to improve, what is that based on? It's based on literally nothing. It's just a hope. So I think I have to leave it at that. I guess I talk about him on the mailbag once every like 3 or 4 months. It's been the same stuff for a long, long time now. There hasn't been a lot of new content, unfortunately. The comments still get a lot of likes. I still like to check in every now and then. He's still somebody who I like to keep my eye on. But overall, it's sad. I miss him at the top of the sport. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot to say recently. From Jacob. Do you envision a scenario where players can make a good living playing mostly on the Challenger Tour? Do you think the ATP/WTA are doing enough to improve the lower tiers of the game? Would something like Saudi investment be used to do this? So the third part of your question is the most interesting, or the last part of your question is the most interesting, because this is where I envision changes happening, which is the introduction of Saudi interest and Saudi money in tennis is forcing change. It is forcing restructuring. And Indian Wells, while the tennis was being played out on the courts, in boardrooms in the back, the most powerful people in tennis were literally discussing monumental changes to how the sport is governed and how the sport is ran. And I think my understanding of why this is necessary at this point is because if tennis does not optimize the structure and the format, that is where it becomes vulnerable to a competing tour. And that's what happened in golf. The Saudis created a competing tour. Everything being done in tennis right now is to avoid that scenario. John Wertheim has used the term, they're playing defense. So playing defense is bringing the Saudis in, involving them, and reforming the entire tour in a certain way that makes everything more secure and robust. And that means, in this case, getting everybody more money, which includes a $1 billion investment, which has been put on the table for the ATP and the WTA to merge. But in as far as I understand, what is being proposed here is that there would be a super tour with 10 Masters 1000 tournaments, including one in Saudi Arabia, and the four slams, men, women combined, and a guaranteed 8-week off season, and periods of rest. 1 week periods of rest before and after each major. So less tennis, more scarcity, more, you know, focus on the premium product and bundling of the media rights, television, sponsorships, bundling it all. ATP, WTA, 10 Masters 1000, 4 slams, it's all together as one. So it can be sold for a really, really, really high value. That appears to be the plan. How does that affect lower ranked players? It completely cuts them out. But before we go all, you know, the world is doomed, the sky is falling, there is always going to be a place for some sort of a transition tour, right? There needs to be a way that you can get on this super tour. And obviously what happens when you go off of it because your results don't keep up. And there needs to be tournaments week in and week out to be played on a developmental or on a lower rung of tennis. I just don't know if that's going to be a part of the tour anymore. So I don't know what the change is going to bring. It can bring more money. It can bring less money. But what it seems is that it might be, it look, basically the ground is shaking. The ground is moving. So what's going to happen? I'm not clear. I'm not clear on that. In fact, it's one of the biggest questions. Biggest questions in all of this is, what does world number 120 look like now? And what do the tournaments, what is the professional tennis outside of those 14 events? What does that look like? I don't know that that question's been answered yet. It's going to be answered. So I wouldn't like panic and be like, you know, the 170th best tennis player in the world is suddenly going to be homeless without income. It's not going to happen. And also all of the 250s and stuff that theoretically would be cut out here. I would assume that in some capacity, many of these venues are going to continue holding professional tennis events. It just might not be a part of this super tour that's being created. And I don't know what that means, and it's hard to say if it's good or it's bad, but it is what it is right now. So let's see what happens. All right, last one. It is just kind of a little fun one to end on, I think. From Max. A while back, I think it was Andy Roddick who suggested being penalized for a bad toss if you begin the service motion, as the rule indicates, but is not enforced. Okay, that was weird wording there, but I think I'm following you. Would you agree with enforcing it? The service points would be a little more exciting, in my opinion, and more interesting, as a bad toss would force a more difficult serve and play with the minds of players. All right, well, look, I don't think it'd be that exciting. I think the player would just have to hit a bad toss. And while I don't think it would be that exciting, it's one of those things where whenever people say, like, look, the service, the toss is part of the skill in serving, that makes perfect sense to me. That makes total sense to me. Right? Like, why should you be able to catch a bad toss? It's your fault that you threw a bad toss. And I get that sometimes it's windy, but like, oh well, just hit the toss. So, and it's pretty annoying. Now, look, there aren't a lot of players who are guilty of this, of just constantly catching tosses. But when it does happen, it is supremely annoying. And I would go as far to say that the only reason why there hasn't been a rule that has outlawed catching tosses is because these players have good tosses and don't catch their tosses a lot. But if we got into a position where it was happening a lot, that, yeah, like it would stink. Like, people might start to think about, this is how rules work, right? Nobody likes to change anything unless a problem emerges. But it's literally annoying for all parties when players have to catch their toss all the time. And I totally am in line with the logic that throwing an accurate toss is part of the skill of serving. It would hurt me. My toss is by far the worst part of my serve. And by the way, probably true for 80% of recreational tennis players. One thing that is, I'll end on this, thoroughly underrated is how good pros are at tossing the ball. It's impressive. And it's the kind of thing that nobody's going to appreciate, because it's like, cool, you toss the ball. But the fact that it's in the same spot every time, it's super key. Super, super key. All right, why am I wearing a hat? I hate hats. It doesn't matter how hot and sunny it is outside. I don't like to wear hats. But I was really sore last night from all the tennis I've played this week. And I'm like, I need a hot shower. And I'm just going to stretch in the shower. So then I woke up this morning and my thought was, I don't want to go back in the shower. I like just showered right before I went to bed. But my hair was all messed up from the pillow. So I threw on a hat and I went about my day. And that is why, maybe for the first time ever, I'm wearing a hat on this YouTube channel. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.